Hello, salam, and welcome back to the Adjam podcast. I'm your host, Belle Cheeves, and I'm here with Sam Hodgkin, assistant professor of comparative literature at Yale. We're going to discuss his book, just released in December of 2023, Persianate Verse and the Poetics of Eastern Internationalism. Sam, I cannot tell you how excited I am to be having this conversation today. I remember when we first met in Tajikistan, what, like 10 years ago?
Something like that.
Yeah. And you were conducting research for your dissertation. And now we're here together discussing the incredible book it has become. It's so good to see you. Thank you
Likewise.
For the tea. I feel like we're back in Tajikistan. This is magnificent. And congratulations on publishing this tour de force.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Belle, for having me to the Adjam Network for hosting this. And Salam Bahame.
Our pleasure. So in this book, you take your reader across vast literary and political landscapes, from what we now know as Iran to Armenia, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, India, Turkey, Soviet Russia, just across so many linguistic and ethnic and generational divides. And you really so beautifully weave together different threads of poetry, film, music, newspapers, and speeches, just to name a few. To show us how Persianate verse both informed and also in different ways was transformed by what you call Eastern internationalism over the 20th century, even beyond the Soviet period. I'd love to start by having you lay the groundwork a bit more for our listeners. What is this book about? What is this Eastern internationalism? Why Persianate verse? And what do you even mean by Persianate?
Yeah, and you're right to highlight the question of this term Persianate, because it's very much a later 20th century scholarly term that doesn't really have any close component for the people I'm writing about in this book. But the story that I'm telling is really the story of how the shared literary culture of activists, revolutionaries, and eventually in the communist bloc, literary bureaucrats, really was the cement that glued together the edifice of communist internationalism insofar as it linked together the communist bloc, the multinational and international communist bloc, with anti-colonial and national activists in what the Soviets called the near abroad. And here I have in mind especially the Ottoman into Turkish Republic Anatolian zone, Iran, Afghanistan, and first British India, and then the nation states of Pakistan and India. And what I think we find is that the communist movement, even more than anti-colonialism and third worldism, really was a transformative force in the period when a sort of shared literary culture in Persian, in Turkic, in languages of South Asia and the Caucasus was nationalized into a bunch of, national literatures, national cultures through the action of government bureaucracies. And so on the one hand, the process of making nationalities and delimiting national cultures in the Soviet Union and also much later in communist China set a pattern that was imitated and competed with by the nation states of Kemalist Turkey, Pahlavi Iran, and then, later in India and Pakistan and Afghanistan. So on the one hand, they were delimiting their cultural nations along lines that had been partly modeled by the communist bloc. But on the other hand, internationalism was this disruptive force that continued to link together national cultures.
Right. So and then is this what you are referring to as this Eastern internationalism? Where do you come up with this term? Because this is your term, right?
Yes. I mean, the East is absolutely a geography, a conceptual geography used by the figures I'm writing about.
Of course.
It goes straight from the Orientalist tradition into, Marxist thought. And at the same time, it goes into the conceptual vocabulary of anti-colonial activists in this zone and communists in this zone. But the East, as they conceive it, is often, in practical terms, the zone that scholars today talk about as Persianate. And the difference between this thing that we've post facto called Persianate and the East, as activists talked about it at the time, is that the Persianate was a sort of real, practical, shared culture that didn't need to be named because it was just, you know, the water around people, you know. whereas the East was not organic in that respect. It was a very intentional transformation of accidents of geographies and culture into a zone of political solidarity.
Right. And so what you're doing here then is sort of tracing the development of this political solidarity through poetry, yes?
Yeah, and not even purely instrumentally, because the thing is that the poetry of internationalism was not just the articulation of an idea that preceded that articulation. It lived in literature. It lived in poetry and slogans.
Right.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So one of the most impressive things to me about this work is that you're working with so many languages, and at least from an outside perspective, would also seem to be so many different literary traditions and genres. Yet you show extremely convincingly how connected and related they all are as you map their transformations across time and space. It's an enormous amount of research, and I'm curious, how did you come to this idea of the Eastern International through this Persian poetic verse? At what point in your research did you start drawing these connections, or did you already have a sense that they were there?
Well, I started out as someone who, as an undergraduate, had done Central Asian literary studies and was in a program training as a Persianist, with a background in some Turkic languages, but essentially as a Persianist, and the task, as I saw it, as I was trying to figure out what kind of a dissertation to write, was how to keep from provincializing a project that I did want to address Central Asian studies and the extraordinary literatures of Central Asia, but, you know, to more properly place them in their world, because, when you say a lot of languages, you know, at the start of the 20th century, I mean, in 1905, when I start my story, in the world of the three revolutions, two of them abortive, one of them successful, in the empires of the Ottoman Empire, the Romanov Empire, and Qajar Iran, the languages were far fewer in practice, because Persian hadn't been delimited into Farsi, Tajiki, and Dari yet, and the distinctions that are so important in written Turkic languages today, were masked, actually, productively masked by Arabic script. And so, of course, there were differences between the written idiom of Tatars in Kazan and people in Istanbul, people in Bukhara, but the degree to which they could read each other's writing was much greater.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So in terms of thinking more about this concept of, you know, Persian literature and poetry, something we've actually talked about on the Ajam podcast before is the concept of adab, becoming adabiyot. But you note that this practice or sort of toolkit, as you say, of adab actually remained in very important ways throughout this period. To refresh the memory of our listeners, can you first just sort of tell us a bit about what these concepts are and how you're using them, and then maybe give us an example of how adab was still very much present in this Eastern internationalism?
Yeah, there's been a lot of wonderful work recently at the boundary between literary studies and institutional history about the making of an institution that looks like the Western institution of literature in the nations of Iran, Afghanistan, the nations of South Asia, and in Turkey. And, you know, on the one hand, it's been told as a story of the transformation of adab, this sort of living set of practices, you know, in which, you know, texts are sort of live in among the ways that they are used,
right,
into this sort of bookshelf or, you know, even set of busts of, you know, literary heroes, you know, where it's very much more like the Western concept of literature, but also inflected by the kind of Orientalist preoccupation with origins and, you know, heroes. So some of the more recent works by scholars like Alexander Jabari and Arya Fani, both of whom just recently had books out on very closely related topics, have emphasized the ways that it's not, adabiyot is not just a calque of literature. It actually continues to carry some of the valences of adab in the age of the nation. There's elements of that same story in my book, but the additional component is that to the degree that adab is sort of excised from adabiyot. And this does happen to some degree. I mean, my book has these examples of where the actual writings of medieval heroic authors are too inconvenient. And so the author continues to be celebrated, but they make up, you know, for biopics, you know, the sort of imaginary things that those authors might have said,
right,
if they were the authors we needed them to be. So that does happen. But to some degree, that adab, you know, that good form, as Mauna Kea has so helpfully described,
right,
adab, of etiquette and apposite use of quotations, the ability to come up with an appropriate extemporaneous poem at the right moment, it goes into the institutional sphere of occasions, of public occasions. You know, a poet goes to an event with collective farmers at the Kremlin and has a poem for the occasion. The Afro-Asian Writers Association has a meeting, and the poets all recite for each other, you know, and build fellow feeling through precisely adab.
Right. Another example, and correct me if I'm misremembering this from the book, is sort of how adab was used for, I believe, as you say, producing emotional effects. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, so living as I do now in a comparative literature department, I mean, and many listeners, I think, will have experienced at least some of this. People who work with or read or write poetry in Western traditions, post-Romantic Western traditions, don't really take poetry seriously as something that can do things,
mm-hmm.
Can have really profound effects. And that's got to do with this kind of anxiety about rhetoricity among practitioners and scholars of poetry after the Romantics. And this tradition just doesn't really have that narrowed sense of what poetry can do.
Mm-hmm.
And this can produce some real nightmares, right? where poetry in the newspaper is being used to sort of underline the importance of, you know, meeting an agricultural quota, even in the middle of a famine, and, you know, with threats of what could happen if the quota isn't fulfilled. You know, obviously, anyone who's encountered the Stalin cult has likely seen the ways that the literatures of the Soviet East were sort of pressed into service of that. But, I mean, okay, there's sort of a limit to what panegyric can do to fight the power that be, right? but there is a long tradition of the sort of implicit gap between the praise and the real facts of the person being praised being a site for kind of trying to negotiate better possibilities for what the ethics of power might be. And, you know, the generations, the first couple generations of, you know, madrasa-educated activists who entered the communist internationalist arena had a lively sense of those possibilities for poetry. But tends to happen in these kind of realms of globalized world literature, and really the Soviet system was the clearest harbinger of institutionalized post-colonial world literature that we have in the first half of the 20th century. These writers entered that sphere, and they all of a sudden had this collapse together of all of these readerships, some of which were equipped to understand their references, their allusions, the subtle suggestions that the poets were making to their addressees. But often their primary addressees were non-speakers of the languages in which the poetry was written, you know, were reading the poems in translation and thought that they had full access to the poems at the same time as they couldn't understand what the poems were about at all, in fact. And so, you know, when this Iranian Kurdish poet who came to occupy an important position in the Soviet literary bureaucracy as, oddly enough, the sort of leading representative of Central Asian literature, when he writes a poem to Stalin, intervening on behalf of this Yiddish theater director who was a friend of his who was under threat. And he fills this poem, which is sort of an allegory about a gardener who takes care of all the flowers in the garden, with these very subtle and ethically charged allusions to the Masnavi of Rumi and, you know, other classical poetic conventions. You know, it just flies right over Stalin's head, you know, and instead it provides an occasion for him to publicly rebuke a sycophant, never mind the complexities of what the poem was actually doing. I mean, now, there's, of course, within the Persianate tradition, a long history of rulers missing the point of poems by poets and poets being regarded as sycophants when they were trying to, you know, steer the state in a good way.
Yes.
But it's way more egregious once we enter this realm of globalized world literature.
So continuing this note of, you know, Persianate versed throughout the ages, not just the 20th century, two of my favorite words that you use in the book when discussing how Persian classical verse is used, or how the conventions are sort of reframed at certain times, are its durability and reverberations throughout some of these moments of revolution and social and cultural transformation. At one point, you even refer to it as a collaboration between past and present, which I love. Can you talk a bit more about this and sort of the moments at which, you know, these classic poetic conventions are reemerging?
Yeah, and I mean, this is especially true in the latter half of the book. So I'll say that the arc that runs through the first half of the book, from the revolutions of 1905 to 1912, and the sort of emergence of a literary culture associated with left politics in Eurasia, to the Stalinist moment, is a pretty grim, pessimistic arc. Even though there are so many, you know, brilliant poets and critics, and, you know, real highlights of, you know, extraordinary work in writing poetry, reading poetry. But the second half of the book, I mean, I didn't want the book to have that shape to it. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons it was very important for me to take it from the thaw period of the post-Stalin years through to the post-Soviet moment.
And, right.
And what you see if you look at that period is that there's a sort of return of the classics in a more genuinely engaged way. Whereas by the late Stalin period, a lot of the uses to which classical Persian forms and canonic texts are put is essentially ventriloquism, is you know, making those forms do things that are even contrary to the meanings contained within the forms. What you get, and this is especially true in the later Soviet period and in the near abroad at that time, is more sampling, more use of the original texts in ways that are genuinely strange in their new contexts. And I think the most famous example of this that I sit with is the extraordinary film by the Armenian director Sergei Parajanov, Nranguina, The Color of Pomegranates, which is very much not a biopic. I mean, the fact is, what we know about the life of the 18th century Armenian bard Sayat Nova is, you know, it's not nothing. We know he worked at a monastery for a while in what's now the Caspian region of Iran, and you know, we have some biographical facts, but what we mostly have is these notebooks of his poetry in Armenian and Georgian and the plurality of it in Turkic. And Parajanov essentially built a movie out of the poetry itself. And it's a very strange movie as a result. It smuggles these kind of visions of gender fluidity and queerness and fluidity of sectarian boundaries, mm-hmm. and linguistic boundaries at the same time as it's not actually an anti-communist film. It really is part of the internationalist tradition, and the receptions of that film, which include its transformation into a model film for a while in the early Islamic Republic of Iran, mm-hmm. Really carried out into other cultural contexts this particular reformation of things that really were in the Persian culture of Sayat Nova for a new world.
Right.
It really is beautiful to see films in which classical Persian poetry really lives.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Oh, and I love how you bring film and these myriad different sort of genres and expressions of this poetic verse into the book as well. It's really striking. Another striking thing about your work to me, which I knew would be in there from having talked to you about some of it already, but it was still just so impressive to see in the final product, is your attention to gender and the women who were a part of building this Eastern International. So often in histories and literary scholarship related to this topic, there are no women, but you find them and you include them and you show how very present they were, both in creating original poetry and also in translation efforts. One woman who comes up throughout several chapters is Jala Isfahani. Can you tell us a bit about her and her role in this Eastern internationalism?
Yeah, so Abul Qasim Lahuti,
yes,
who was sort of a young poet of 1905, who, you know, after leading a failed coup in 1921, ends up in the Soviet Union and takes on this bureaucratic role. And Jala Isfahani is really kind of his counterpart of the younger generation. So she was the only woman poet to be featured at the Iranian Writers' Congress in 1946, which took place, you know, under Soviet patronage after the Soviet invasion of northern Iran, but was just an absolutely foundational moment for the Iranian literature of the second half of the 20th century. And, you know, she was introduced by Mohammad Taqi Bahar, you know, which is just the most clear handoff of poetic authority that you can imagine. You know, she's a recognized young poet. Her husband was a young Air Force pilot, you know, one of the first pilots in the Iranian Air Force, and he stole a plane and flew it over to Soviet lines.
Oh my God.
Shortly before you know, he was a communist, and he was committed to that project, and so when the Red Army had to leave Iran, he and his wife, who you know, had not been especially political up to that point, were evacuated to Soviet Azerbaijan. And she, you know, began trying to figure out how to make a life for herself in this new world. She learned Azerbaijani and began translating contemporary and classical poets to Persian.
Mm-hmm.
And then a poem of hers about nuclear disarmament came to the attention of the leading Tajik literary figure, Sadruddin Aini.
Uh-huh.
He invited her to visit. And you know, soon she built up a real career as a poet, a teacher, and a very important scholar of Persian poetry in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after the Islamic Revolution, a brief time in Iran, she ended up living out the rest of her life in London. And so that's where the family archive is, the family, together with the local Iranian community there, established a Jale Foundation that is very important in sort of Persianate literary community across borders today.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I was lucky enough to be able to meet with her son.
How wonderful.
But really, I mean, this is not, you know, just a matter of like including women in the story to make sure that they're in there. I mean, their roles, you know, as translators and as writers and scholars, was absolutely formative. In her case, she is the link, who brought the Nima style, you know, the basically this transformation that had happened in Iranian poetry to a Central Asian world where the transformations of literary modernity had happened by way of, you know, Mayakovsky and Nazım Hikmet, and not by way of Nima, despite Nima's communist politics early on. So she is just an absolute, you know, linchpin.
Right.
And then add to that the fact that her poetry is really extraordinary.
Yes. Speaking of which, Should we read some?
Yeah. I'll read one of my favorite poems of hers. And it's a poem that is, you know, it looks like a real, you know, standard lyric poem. You know, it's not in the Ghazal form, but it's definitely got that tarazol, that kind of lyricism of spring and love and all of that. But there's a political sting in the tail of the poem,
of course,
that really makes it clear why lyricism matters for people who are fighting for a better world, and it is in fact important. So this poem that I thought I'd read is Armaron, or The Gift, written in 1966 or 67. Armaron. شنیدم دختری زیبا فرستاده برای مهربان یارش کتاب شعر پر درد و امیدم را چو صبح نوبهار از بوسه خورشید لبان غنچه ها وا شد چو موج باد در دریای گل پنهان و پیدا شد چو شد آینه برکه زمرود گون ز زلف بید چو لاله سر کشید از دامن صحرا که بیند رقص درناهای عاشق را تماشایی ترین رقص بهشتی رقص بیمانند شنیدم آن دو دل داده میان سبزه ها با یک دیگر خواندند کتاب شعر پر درد و امیدم را چه پاداشی برای شاعر از این به که روز رزم شعرش سنگر آزادگان باشد و گاه بزم در بین جوانان ارمغان باشد.
The Gift. I heard that a beautiful girl sent her kind sweetheart my book full of poems, full of hopes and cares. On a morning in early spring, as, kissed by the sun, the lips of the rosebuds parted, as a wave of wind came in and out of sight in a sea of roses, as the willow's tresses turned emerald the mirrored pond, as the tulips raised their heads out of the field to watch the dance of cranes in love, the most spectacular, heavenly dance, incomparable dance. I heard that those two lovers read together among the greenery my book of poems, full of hopes and cares. For a poet, what better recompense? In fighting for their poems to be a stronghold, in feasting between two youths, a gift. It's so beautiful. Oh, and thank you for reading it in Persian as well. So one of the points that you make in your introduction, you encourage any of your readers to actually, even if they don't know the language, to read aloud the transliterations of these poems. Tell us more about that. Why is that?
As no end of poetry scholars will tell you, you know, any kind of form-content divide is problematic, especially in poetry, where the form is so much a part of the message.
Right.
And I think, you know, the way these poems sound is the whole thing.
Yes.
You know, this is where someone in the Kremlin who thought they knew what these poems were reading them in translation, you know, was just completely missing it. And also, you know, what sounds sort of wooden and, you know, just sloganeering in translation, often you can understand where its power and maybe even its baleful power came from when you hear it out loud. And this is a poem that, you know, anyone who's ever read a ghazal, there's so much of the poem that will be familiar to them. You know, it's full of everything that makes the Persian poetic tradition so beautiful. It's in the Nimai form. It's not a classical ghazal, but it's just full of that. But this sense of the process of transmission, you know, what it is for poetry to go into new contexts and to get used by people who need it.
Yes.
You know, and people who you wouldn't necessarily, the poet didn't plan for when they wrote the poem, but they maybe hoped for, is so important. And then the last reason I wanted to read this poem, there's this phrase that's everywhere in the Persian canon, razmo bazm, right? Like this pairing that, you know, in a romance, a masnavi, or you know, in the tradition more broadly, you've got fighting and you've got feasting, and so you've got, you know, the sort of the alternation between, you know, what we might think of as epic of struggle, you know, geopolitics,
right?
All of that with you know, the other needs that we have. You know, it's bread and roses, and this is a poem that's about that need that we have for both, and the ways that poetry can and should be part of both.
Right. Oh, I love that. That's really fantastic.
I mentioned Abul Qasim Lahouti earlier. Yes. His wife was a Ukrainian Jewish Orientalist named Cecilia. She took the pen name / last name Banu, who produced really, I mean, I haven't read every translation of the Shahnameh into every language, but it, I mean, I think it has, among those who are capable of reading Russian, a deserved reputation as the most miraculous translation of the Shahnameh ever. And it's the whole thing. And it really is a masterpiece. And you know, Lahouti and Banu kind of wrote together. You can really see the sort of the way that translation can be this space where the possibilities of internationalism, the possibilities of political solidarity, comparability, you know, and like awareness of each other, and the deep loving spirit of adab, actually was, at least in certain moments and in certain communities, realized even against the horrific backdrop of the purges and forced partitions, forced population transfers, just all of the nightmares of the communist 20th century. There were people on the ground who were trying in a real way to realize its possibilities in spite of all that, and poetry played an important role in that. This was such an eminently practical tradition about trying to make things happen, trying to change the world with language.
Yes.
And that's really, you know, if we sort of fetishize, you know, the specificities of what these texts did in particular contexts too much, then we take away the power with which their authors wanted to imbue those texts.
Absolutely. So this makes me think of another line that I absolutely loved, and thinking in terms of, you know, poetry out of its, the context of its time and place, a couple of lines by Rudaki that you include. One shouldn't be glad for what comes, and one shouldn't dwell on what departs. This world of regrets is just wind and clouds. Bring more wine. Whatever will be, will be.
Yes, well,
that this feels just very relevant always.
Well, it caused some anxiety because, you know, it was included in this this sampler of Tajik literature.
Right.
And, you know, the young proletarian critics, you know, said, what kind of a message is this for a young communist? But I think, you know, this is where Jalle gives us the answer that, you know, when you're living in the indeterminacies of history, sometimes you need both the conviction to try and make things better, but also the space to shrug your shoulders a little bit.
Absolutely. Oh, I think that's an excellent note to end on, quite frankly. Thank you, Sam. It has been a pleasure talking with you today. And I can't wait to see what you do next. For those of you who are interested in reading Sam's book, Persian at Verse and the Poetics of Eastern Internationalism, it was just released in December of 2023 by Cambridge University Press and should be available wherever you like to get your books.
And I would say it's maybe one of the most Ajam Media Collective books ever produced. So
I love that. Yes, it that, really is. I mean, it really covers all our territory. Thank you for joining us, Sam. This has
Thank
been
you so
great.
Much.